That would help. You look short enough, you can remember it all.
The meeting of the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee will come back to order. We've been in recess, and we have three bills. And we can do this. We don't have to be here into the wee hours by any means. Senator Scogan, I was going to do a different order, but we just soon get going, and you're here. And
I appreciate that.
And Senator Olson has to go back to the Judiciary Committee, as I do actually as well. I even have a bill to present there, but this way Senator Olson can participate in the conversation about this. I know it affects her district as well.
Sure.
Senator Scogan.
Members, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 894 is actually a pigtail of some work that we did last year. Last year, you might remember that we authorized a study be done. We had questions from not only the resorters, but from cabin owners who were wondering how many people were renting out their homes and what kind of rules and regulations were guiding those rentals. And we didn't have those numbers or those answers, so we last year authorized a study to be done and a report to be written to tell us what vacation home rentals were like out in the Lakes Country. And I think in the next few minutes, members, you'll see that we have opened a bit of a can of worms with that, although my particular bill before you is a result of that study, and we have a definition of a vacation home rental. And Joel Carlson is here to help me talk about the study a little bit and the results of that study. And I know there are others who want to speak to it as well, but I don't know whose stuff that is. But
Madam Chair, can I
just push it over to the side a little bit?
I don't want to set up.
Yes, no, for sure. I think I don't. That should be fine. Senator Scogan, members do have the the executive summary of the report as well.
Okay, good.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own the research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I represent the Congress of Minnesota Resorts. And with me is Tim Arsvold, who's a resorter from Geneva Beach Resort in the Alexandria area. And both Mr. Arsvold and I served on the Vacation Rental Home Task Force. And what is before you in Senate File 894 is the consensus of the task force. And I know Colleen Tollefson from Explore Minnesota Tourism was going to be here to talk about the report, and she has just arrived. But we support clarify. Our problem for resorters was not that we don't want competition or that we don't want people to rent their homes. Our issue is that there should be a level playing field and that there should be a clear definition in law of what is a vacation rental home, when they are regulated and when they aren't. And I believe that the task force report embodies an effort to accomplish that. The definition of a vacation rental home is what you have before us here, Senate File 894. There are other issues that are related to the Department of Health relative to their licensures and fees that are not necessarily our particular issue. I think they would like to address them. But our purpose in bringing the study forward and having this report before you was to begin the process of establishing the ground rules for vacation rental homes. And we think we've done that. And I think, Madam Chair, I think Colleen Tollefson from EMT should at least address the report. It was their work product. We're here to support it and answer questions as you may have them.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. And Ms. Tollefson, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Colleen Tollefson with Explore Minnesota Tourism. And our office was asked to do a report on vacation home rental during the last legislative session. And basically what we looked at was consumer protection, tax compliance, safe rentals, and the promotion of tourism. Just to clarify, when we looked at vacation home rental, what we primarily looked at was vacation home rentals operating as a business, meaning that they were advertised and available to the public on an ongoing basis. What we were not looking at was you and I with our cabins, sharing them with our families, friends, and relatives, and maybe charging a slight fee for a week or two. We were looking at something that was operating as a business. Our task force included other state agencies, including health and revenue, planning and zoning folks, tourism businesses, industry associations, realtors. We added vacation homeowners because they expressed a strong interest in participating, and then the University of Minnesota Tourism Center. And I can say we had a number of meetings, and we had very high attendance and participation. In terms of vacation home rentals, vacation home rental is a very common practice throughout the United States and also throughout the world. Second home owners have become pretty active operators, but it's not limited to second home owners. Examples of how large it is: in Hawaii, about 5,800 of their visitor units are vacation home rentals. In North Carolina, about 23,000 of their units are vacation home rentals. In Minnesota, we estimate there's over 100,000 seasonal recreational homes, and the common thought on vacation homes is that it's largely a cabin by a lake, but it is definitely not limited to a lake or a rural area. It also includes metropolitan areas, and it also is not limited to second homes. In terms of where it fits into the whole picture of lodging and tourism, I think you're all well aware that the lodging industry is really evolving in Minnesota. The number of resorts is declining. In the past 15 years, we've developed a pretty vibrant bed and breakfast industry, and now what we see is that vacation home rentals are kind of an emerging area that will become a part of the lodging industry. Some of the concerns and the reason that this has been growing in concern is that, first of all, one thing that distinguishes a vacation home from most other types of lodging is that there is not an on-site manager. And so one of the concerns is a way to make this both safe and viable as an industry, but we also have to be sure that we're addressing consumer expectations at the same time. From a tourism industry standpoint, what you're looking at is a lot of different business operators, whether they're hotel, motel, resort, cabin, bed and breakfast, who want to be sure that they are competing as a business in a level playing field. So the things that we looked at were health department licensing, building code requirements, septic, plumbing, water, fire safety, zoning, tax payment, and insurance payments. So those were some of the areas that we took a look at and had representation on our task force. There are some sort of overall consumer and neighbor operational issues as well, and they're due to a lot of factors. One of them is that a lot of vacation homes, probably most, operate in what's classified as a residential area, but now it's a commercial operation within a residential area. And the other one is that there is no on-site manager. So some of the issues that I think are really growing, judging from the number of phone calls we get in our office, are overcrowding within the property itself, overall maintenance, issues with noise and parking when guests are there, issues with garbage and where to place it, trespassing on neighbors' property, and just overall enforcement issues. We looked at some other states just to get a feel for how this was handled and regulated in other states. So we looked at 9 other states, and what we found is that all of them have some form of regulation for vacation homes, both at the state level and then in many cases at the local, either county or city level. The other thing we did was we looked at a sample of 9 counties in Minnesota. And what we did was, because I think there's a lot of question of how big is this in Minnesota, and I can't just give you a number. It's not as easy as that. But we looked at 9 sample counties all throughout the state. And what we did was we went to the websites that list vacation homes. And what we found is that there's over 800 websites that list vacation homes. We just sampled 3 of those websites for the 9 counties that we were looking at, and we came up with over 500 vacation homes for Minnesota listed on those 3 websites alone. So although we can't give you a specific number as a sample of a very limited number of websites, there are a number of vacation homes being rented on those. Then what we did was we looked at the existing Minnesota regulations. The health department in Minnesota Statute 157, which covers their lodging area, The vacation homes would be covered within that area, but not clearly defined. And the area that it covers is businesses renting a week or more with five or more units would be included in the existing health department requirements. But it does leave a little bit of unclarity in terms of the definition of vacation homes and then how that fits into this. That would cover areas like ADA, septic, plumbing, fire safety, zoning, and then tax compliance or having a tax identification number. We also looked at the revenue department, and their statutes, Minnesota Statute 297A.61, would cover short-term rentals. One of the things that's kind of unclear in there is that there's some occasional use or occasional sale exemptions, and vacation home, again, is not clearly defined, and so how it would fit in within the occasional sales needs to be more clearly defined. We looked at other requirements like real estate licensing requirements, shoreland, zoning, and what we found was that this is obviously a very much a multi-jurisdictional issue, and so there isn't a lot of clarity in a lot of different areas, but there are regulations in a number of these areas, just not clearly known. Our recommendations were to address the health department regulations, the revenue regulations, and provide a communications plan. And the bill before you addresses the health department regulation in the area of adding a definition of vacation homes, and that was one of our primary recommendations. We also would like to see some reference to vacation homes within the licensing and fee area. And then we were also recommending an exemption for a one-time donation annually. If somebody was taking their vacation home and donating it for a charitable purpose, that there wouldn't be a one-time annual exemption for that. Within the revenue department, we would like to see vacation homes defined as an isolated or occasional sale, to have that more clearly defined as well. And what we're recommending is that it follows the federal guidelines of 14 days or less when it's considered an occasional sale versus an ongoing business operation.
Ms. Thompson, may I, excuse me for interrupting you, but do you mean 14 days by one? Are you mean total of 14 days in a year, don't I assume?
Yes.
Is that
14 days in a year?
Total in a year.
Yes. And then our final recommendation, and whether there's regulatory changes or not, Explore Minnesota will be following through with the rest of the task force on this recommendation, is that what we need to very clearly communicate what the guidelines are for vacation home rental. Some of it is a regulatory issue. Some of it might be considered a little bit more of just a common sense how you deal with your neighbors and how you operate in a residential neighborhood. But we do need to communicate that as well. Our final kind of outlook is that this will be very much a growth area within Minnesota, and so we feel it's really important that it's managed appropriately and that it's a safe option and that it's operated on a level playing field with other tourism businesses.
Ms. Tollefson, thank you. Is there a Mr. Lauterbach?
Ready.
I can't believe I stumbled over your name. My maiden name is Longabaugh. So, good evening. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, thank you for this opportunity. I'm just going to make this brief. Colleen touched on a few of the points that I want to talk about.
I need you to identify yourself. And
I am Mark Lauterbaugh. I am an affected homeowner. Okay. So I'm a real live affected homeowner. Okay.
Not one who rents your home, but
no,
someone
who
lives
affected,
near homes that are rented.
Correct. Okay. My wife and I purchased a home on Maple Lake in Wright County about 6 years ago. Past year, we've been directly impacted by an adjacent vacation home turned into a mini resort, serving about over 100 people went through it last summer on a rental basis. Went down to Wright County Planning. Basically, they indicated they had no zoning or regulations to deal with this type of activity, even though it wasn't a residential zone. They were aware of the task force, and they basically told me that they were looking to see where that ended up and the results of that. I contacted my senator. She got me in touch with John and Colleen on the task force, and I became an active member of that. And a note of appreciation for them is in order for the difficult task they had of bringing a number of wide range of interests together. Just briefly, here's what I experienced. Loss of peace and quiet, overflow parking in the street due to lack of parking space, overcrowding, 10 to 12 people in a two-bedroom cabin, insufficient bedroom fire egress for basically only a one legal bedroom. Septic system is permitted for two bedrooms, and it's advertised as three bedrooms plus a bunkhouse. No Minnesota Health Department permits. Numerous safety issues. And based on the advertised rates, I calculated that it was an income of about $10,000 to $12,000. Unregulated, where there were no expenses that had to be applied against that, as a resort would have to, because they're not regulated. I believe that clarification and direction from the state legislature would assist local units of government in developing strategies to deal with vacation home rentals. And that's all I have to say.
Mr. Lauterbaugh, do you know the neighbors, I mean, who own the
Absolutely.
Cabin? And are they people who have generally been there, but this they just started renting it? Or
they were there for about a year before they started. They turned it into a resort, yes.
When you say resort, there's more than... It's one building.
It's one building with a small bunkhouse.
Okay.
I'm being a little facetious when I say resort.
Okay. Okay.
But there were over 100 people went through it, and it was a constant flow of people. And it's... I'm not saying that you shouldn't be able to rent your property. There should be some regulations to it. And it's a typical... You know, as you might guess, the weekend rentals were, you know, the first thing that comes down the sidewalk is the small keg or the booze. It's party atmosphere.
Well, you've come to the right committee. We just did the liquor bill.
Oh, we did? Yeah. Okay.
I'm sorry. You wouldn't believe we, that committee. Senator Marty, did you have a question for Mr. Lauterbaugh?
Madam Chair, Mr. Lauterbaugh. When you talked about 10,000 to 12,000 and 100 people in a year, like how many weekends are they living there most of the year, and then they rent it out for?
No, they don't live there. That's their vacation home. They like right now during the winter they're fixing it up for this coming rental season. Once in a while they'll have an occasional winter rental, but it's really starts with the summer. They rent their home. They rent their pontoon boat, their fishing boat. I mean, it's a full-fledged operation, and it's advertised on the Internet.
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank Explore Minnesota for the work they've done on this, too, and to Senator Scogin for carrying this bill, because I know it's not an easy issue. I mean, it really is complicated. There are lots of different interests involved. And I was really interested when this first was coming up in my district and knowing what some of the other states were doing and how they've handled it. A couple of the issues I still have, or I think about it in both directions, because of the Star Lakes legislation this last summer, I went to a lot of Lake Association meetings back in my district, and I heard concerns similar to the concern that this gentleman has just described. I had, you know, firsthand stories of people who would say this is a party house next door. It's really detrimental to the health of the lake because people aren't following regulations there, and there's nobody there to enforce them. There's nobody there to really kind of keep track of things. And most of the people who live on the lake, I would say, you know, the vast majority of people who live on the lake and have an ownership interest in that property, whether it's a resort owner or a homeowner, are concerned about the lake because that, you know, the value of their property is tied to that. When you remove that ownership interest and you don't have anyone there supervising, you have people who aren't necessarily as concerned about it. And so, you know, I heard stories that would confirm over and over exactly what this witness said. But then I also think of, you know, from personal experience, I'll admit that like a year and a half ago when my daughter got married over by Lake Minnetonka, there were no motels in the area. I went online. I found somebody's house that was for sale, but in the meantime, you could rent it for the weekend. And we did, and that gave us a place to have gift opening and get ready before the wedding. And this was someone who was trying to sell the house, but it helped them to get some income in the meantime. You know, while they were trying to sell the house, when I would imagine a lot of people are in that situation today, you know. The other thing, a couple of the questions, and maybe someone here can answer this. I'm wondering, by doing this definition, and I looked at all the other states, it seems like most of the other ones had specific rules for this type of property, whereas our approach would be just by definition kind of make the rules exactly the same as they would be for, you know, other, I think, as it was said here, level the playing field. So we're going to put the same rules on these properties as we have on resorts and other kinds of you know, full-time businesses, which some of these, I guess, are. So I guess one issue I would have is, do we want to do completely the same regulations? I don't think there are any other states that do that, but maybe it's the right thing to do. I'm concerned a little bit about how timeshares are handled. I'm not sure how they're handled right now, but I know that there's a large business in my district that has a concern. That I heard from, and so maybe they don't want me to name them, or they could be here. But you know, there's a concern there.
Yeah, Senator Olson, are they concerned about this bill? Is that what you mean?
Right, right. And I guess what I'm not sure. Maybe we could get some explanation about whether maybe they're already under the rules as timeshares. I'm not sure.
Madam Chair and members, and you may hear me say this more than once tonight, and maybe we're going to need some time. But you're going to hear from your people, Senator Olson, and others who have gone beyond what Senate File 894 is. We were looking for a definition of a vacation home rental, and that's what we have, and that's what I'm looking to put in statute is what a definition of a vacation home rental. There are people that are going to testify tonight that want to add rules and regulation and licensure and we, as a resort association, weren't interested in that at this step. We wanted a definition so we knew who we were dealing with.
Senator Olson?
Well, Madam Chair,
I believe that's accurate.
And maybe I'm misunderstanding this, but I thought by where this would be placed in law with this definition that this would bring this within the scope of the requirements similarly to how resorts and other businesses are treated in terms of the Department of Health and zoning regulations and that kind of thing. So I thought that that's what this does. And then one other, and so maybe that can be clarified, but then one other thing that I thought maybe we ought to think about is just, I think where this is the biggest problem is on water. You know, that's usually where it comes up and where there are special safety issues and cleanliness issues and more restrictions. And I wonder if we really want to, I guess I'm just thinking of hunting, you know, and people who might go, for example, my husband likes to hunt snow geese in South Dakota. And, you know, he goes down there and depending on where the geese are, there are people who will let you stay, farmers who will let you stay. They like to get the geese out of their fields. And so, you know, you can find online places will let you come and stay and they charge you. But, you know, is that really a problem? Is that really competing? And, you know, so I just wanted to throw that out there, too.
Madam Chair and members, on page 11 of the report, it's pretty clear that Explore Minnesota Tourism was looking to tourism industry associations to initiate these statutory changes. We took on the definition in this Senate file, knowing full well that other groups who were going to be regulated in a more in a different way, and the Department of Health would come forward with their changes and suggestions. And so this is the piece of it that we wanted to initiate the debate with. Now, you need to know that a number of establishments right now get licensed from the Department of Health as vacation rental homes. They are licensed as lodging establishments. And so they are appropriately in the right place being licensed as a lodging establishment. We're not changing that in any way. We're just making it clear that they are not a hotel, they're not a motel, they're not a resort, they are a vacation rental home. And I think you're going to hear from the Department of Health about their suggestions about licensure. But we initiated this step to get the ball rolling. And I can tell you, I've been to a number of those hunting and fishing places. They may be due for a little regulation. I'm just teasing, but that was our purpose, is to get this ball rolling. We know there's an issue out there. We know that there are both neighbor concerns and level playing field concerns, and this is our effort to get this process initiated, and that's why Senator Scogin.
Right, and I just might say, and then Senator Olson, I'll call on you, but I think this is kind of the beginning of the discussion, and we would send the bill to the Health and Health Committee, Senator Marty, and I think it probably, at some point, depending on what you do there, should probably be considered by the Tax Committee. I realize that as it reads right now, it really doesn't have, it just has an implication. It doesn't, it's not direct at all. So,
Madam Chair, one of the things we learned in dealing with health and revenue is that a number of establishments that are currently licensed as vacation rental homes are doing the local lodging tax. They are doing the licensure. They are having the septic inspections. So much of the debate we had is that they're already subject to regulation. We don't know how many more are out there that aren't, but there are a number of them that currently are.
Yeah. So, Senator Olson.
Well, and Madam Chair, and I'm sure we'll hear this through the testimony, but the one thing I guess that isn't revealed by, you know, this language, because it's really more what does that mean when you put this language into our statutes and in terms of where it's at, is, okay, so what does that exactly mean in terms of regulation that will apply as far as zoning regulations, fees? You know, it sounded like from a little bit from what I heard before that maybe there are some now laws that will become applicable to these, but maybe some others, like with taxes, it still won't be. And so I know that this is an issue we need to address. I know it's a problem in the state, but I'm still not exactly clear exactly by doing this what this does in terms of changes it would make.
Other than give us a definition of what a vacation home rental is, that's it?
Right, and Senator Scogin, we're wondering what are the implications of that? What happens because of that definition? And
right.
Well, I think we're going to walk this. Madam Chair, I think you said it. This is the first step in the process to level the playing field, deal with the disgruntled neighbors, and force people who make money off rentals to abide by some rules and regulations. I don't know if...
No, is this Mr. Forrester?
No, I'm Mr. Arsbold.
I think he was introduced right away, and
I'm with the Congress of Minnesota Resorts also. I'm a resort owner.
Oh, okay. What is your name, sir?
Tim Arsbold.
Could you spell that for us?
A-A-R-S-V-O-L-D.
Okay. And you're with the Congress of Resort Owners?
Yes. I own a resort in Alexandria, a motel in Alexandria, apartments in Alexandria, and I'm a real estate broker.
So, well, welcome.
And I was on the task force with this, too. I think, you know, getting the definition into place can be helpful because we've had issues in Douglas County also. We had a court case in regards to problems with neighbors and the parking problems and that type of issue. And that is some of what needs to get regulated on a local basis. But to get the taxation, to get the licensure, as a motel, I'm licensed by the state for the health department. My resort's licensed by the state. Both of those are licensed by the city. My apartments are licensed by the city. They're all inspected by fire inspectors. The health department and HRA comes through for another inspection. So part of what you're looking at is the safety and concerns when it gets down to... What's the egress ability of these bedrooms and sleeping conditions that we have to abide by? When I did a reconstruction on part of my resort, the health department made me move dirt and build a wall. It cost me $30,000 because I needed to meet some egress situations that fell into the code. Well, these houses may or may not fall into that situation. So as a residence, when I remodeled my house to the resort, it was okay as a residence, but it's not okay as a commercial property. So there's a lot of different things that these homeowners and vacation homeowners don't have to fall into if they aren't regulated to some degree and have to be looked at by the inspectors that we have to have come through our properties.
So, okay, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think...
Joel has a, or Mr. Carlson has a, an answer to your question now that we've established what they are, where they fall in statute.
And Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I apologize. I had to grudgingly run out to the parking lot and deliver my final four tickets to someone that can go to the game. Final five, excuse me. Anyway, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, they are licensed as lodging establishments under the Department of Health regulations, certain square feet per bedroom, and that is where they fall. Now, the Department of Health is going to tell you that without their amendment, the conforming amendments that are included in the report, that they would not be able to regulate these. We don't object to that, but we think that they are the best entity to speak to that.
Okay, thank you. Senator Olson?
So in other words, Madam Chair, by putting this definition in law, does that mean that now these rentals will be treated as lodging establishments and essentially subject to the same rules and regulations as opposed to right now where they are not, or maybe it's questionable whether they are?
Madam Chair and
Mr. Carlson,
it is not questionable whether or not they are subject to the regulations. It may be questionable that some of them get the license, but if you are advertising and holding your facility out as a lodging establishment, you are subject to licensure today, right now. The only problem is that when you go to the book and look it up, you see that you're subject as a hotel or a motel, which is how they license them right now, and we think that that's confusing. That's why we have the definition.
So, is there anybody else who wished to testify? Yes, please come up. And is Mr. Forrester here?
The NCAA's.
Welcome.
Thank you. My name's Karen Anderson. I am a cabin owner. I would like to see this definition used to exempt single cabin vacation rentals myself. First of all, my initial take on this was, why is this definition being put in? And I appreciate Senator Olson pressing that issue. Does this, because I talked to staff on the here at the Capitol today, and they said that adding this definition does not mean that there's anything in the law that applies to it. It's standing out there by itself as number 20. It's not referred to in the law yet. And my thought was, aha, they're going to use this cabin rental definition to put all these rules and regulations on my cabin in particular, but I speak for a number of friends and other people. My cabin's on Lake Vermilion in St. Louis County.
Is it something that you advertise online, or you kind of hold out to the public as being available for rental?
I do.
Okay.
The reason being, I am a single owner of that cabin. My parents purchased it over 60 years ago. They have passed on. I'm an only child. I cannot afford to keep it. My children want it. They can't afford it yet. I do not have a choice but to rent it some in the summer to pay my exorbitant taxes. I'm not allowed as a homeowner up there because I'm not a resident there. I'm not allowed to have a say in anything about it, even though, I've got such stature, and I've been there over 60 years. Tell you how old I am. As far as the licensure goes, I really think that it's unfair. If you were up there and you talked to minors, people who are out of work, their cabins have been in their families for years and years and years, and they once or twice a summer rent to cover their – they don't want to rent. And I don't know about these other lakes or the other places, but Senator Olson brought up that it's a broad spectrum with a complex base of issues here. So I'm presenting what I know from my lake. To up there, it's come before our town council, Greenwood Township, and they want to put in a $750 fee. And then you have to pass all these things, and you have to pay the inspection fee and so forth and so on.
For health and safety kinds of requirements.
Yes. We did a little, put together some numbers for the number of, for what our township would have to go through in the, because this is all collected on the local level, locally administered.
Mm-hmm.
So our little township has to have their clerk do this much extra work and this much extra paperwork. And we calculated for the number of weeks that we rent and the, what is it? What's the percentage of tax? 12%? 8%?
For what?
That we would have to pay on our income rental to this tourism tax. What is the percentage?
Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair and members, I don't think that the bill addresses that at all. If she's talking about a local lodging tax that is imposed on lodging facilities that varies by county, I don't know exactly what it is in Cook or St. Louis, but some municipalities have that, but it only applies to lodging establishments that are in the business of lodging.
Well, by this definition, you're saying that we're going to fall into that category. So, anyways, we calculated it based on some number like 12% or whatever I thought. I don't remember where we got the number. But the point was the dollar amount of revenue that was going to be raised didn't even vaguely come close to the staff time it was going to take to administer this. That's one point. The nuisance issue, keep in mind this is single family that I am referring to. The nuisance issue and the health issues should all have been addressed, are all the same, regardless of whether it's a rental family or an owner family. Some people on the lake are obnoxious, and they bring their grandkids up every weekend and run their jet skis till midnight or whatever. And it's the same for the rental property. It's one family or one family and friends. I tell you, on my road, it was my kid, the owner's child, that caused the most problems, him having parties up there. So that issue should be taken off the table. It is up to the neighbor who has the complaint to call the local authorities. There are rules and regulations around every lake, as Senator Olson said, and those should be enforced, and that should be not an issue in this. To me, it doesn't hold water as an issue regarding licensing. As for the competition, the people that rent single-family cabins do not want the loud noise and the obnoxious, multiple families on top of one another parts of resorts. Now, some people like that, but I'm saying the people that I rent to want the peace and quiet and the privacy of a single-family home. That's why they come. Excuse me for a minute. The issue of Hawaii. We did a lot of research about Hawaii. There was, because we knew this study was going to be done, which, by the way, has not been widely publicized. We all up there are keeping our eyes open for it, and no one has seen or heard of it, so I'd love to get a copy.
Ms. Anderson, it was a report that was due to the legislature, and we have a copy of it for you here.
Thank you.
So
it wasn't publicly, it wasn't put out there publicly.
Oh, yet. It's available online.
Oh, online? Okay, thank you.
And EMT issued a news release when it came out, and I know that other publications picked it up as well.
Okay, thank you. Well, and I missed that.
Okay.
In Hawaii, there were significant repercussions for the local economies when this type of legislation was put in. I don't know who I would forward that to, but I have a copy of an article about the significant, it was thousands of small families whose incomes were impacted by not being able to rent their house during, the high season. Significant impact on people's lives. Now, that all that being said, if all of this boils down to the need for some kind of regulation, because you do have to take into account the wide spectrum of different kinds of property rentals, like Mr.
Lauterbach
has the issue with, if it does come down to some kind of licensure, I would ask that the category be broken down further. For instance, if it's a person, the owner owns three or four cabins, obviously that is not, it's not for their personal use primarily. If another thing I would ask is that perhaps there could be a grandfathering clause or an income level. For instance, like I say, some of my neighbors up there are out of work or, you know, are seniors, and the only way they can afford it is to, because the taxes on lake property are tremendous. Anyways, I would ask that that be considered. The other thing that's of interest to me is how, if in fact I do pay the $750 and go through the hassle of having my property inspected and everything, how would, A, you enforce that going forward? To me, it's a mind-boggling idea to have to enforce all that. But how would I, as a as that cabin rental owner, benefit by those tourism tax dollars? Because that's what the resort owners get out of this. They get individualized advertisements. That's what the purpose of the money is, to increase tourism.
You're talking obviously, the lodging tax. And, yes. And I don't know how that is spent, too. I don't think it's just distributed to resort owners. Mr. Carlson, do you know?
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, local lodging tax is, I think it's in 297 under local 69 on how those can be spent. There's specific requirements. I can assure you none of that money goes directly to any lodging establishment. They can promote tourism in general, but none of it goes specifically to any establishment.
It does go to
Sanderson.
Thank you. It does, however, some of those materials that promote tourism do list the resorts. And so the idea that competition is an issue here, to me, goes out the window as well, because if you do start taxing the individual cabins, then we get to have our name listed there, our cabin name listed there, too. So that, to me, dispels the competition question. Anyways, I appreciate your listening to me. I'm just glancing down here to see if I caught everything that I wanted to say. I reiterate, I think that small single cabin owner rentals should be exempt. We have to have our septics up to par anyways. We can't house more people, and 99% of the single cabin owners love their cabins. They don't want to rent to rowdy, destructive people. And believe me, if you find out you've got a tenant like that, you get up there and you kick them out, and you don't let them back. The people I rent to are grandma and grandpa, one or two kids, and a couple grandkids, and they love it. And I think that's a good tradition to have in Minnesota, and I hope we can keep that. Thank you.
Sanderson, thank you. I think that's an important and invaluable perspective. This is really the beginning. Well, last year getting the report was the very beginning of the conversation, but now we're, you know, just kind of receiving the information and finding out. And this committee, this is new ground for this committee, but I think we know it. This bill would need to go to the health committee, and then at some point it would have to go to the tax committee, and possibly and finance if there's licensing fees. So it has quite a ways to go, and I don't know if Senator Scogin's going to navigate all that way this year or not, but we're just beginning the conversation. I really appreciate that you came. Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Scogin, I was just wondering if it would need to go to the Environmental Committee, too, since there are environmental issues. Or I don't know if they're going to, if they've asked to see it or not.
On what gets amended to it.
And, sir, would you like to testify?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Forster.
Well, you are in the room. I'm sorry, I didn't see that
room.
You were. Okay.
I was behind the pillar.
Okay.
I couldn't see you, but I was back
Thank
there.
Thank you.
I am Executive Director of Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners, and we sat on the committee. As an organization, we concur with the resort community that like businesses should be treated similarly in state law. If somebody buys a property and they're renting it out and this is their business and it's a cabin or it's a condo or it's whatever it is, well, then, yeah, that's a business. Ms. Anderson, who I have not met before, kind of brings up the other side of the story. You know, we agree with the principle of this idea in the study, but find the execution to be far too narrow and limiting. MSRPO as a group does not represent vacation home rental owners. We represent cabin owners and hunting land owners. And from time to time, some of these owners do rent out their places to family, friends, or acquaintances. And this is a legitimate use of their property based on our conversations with the 6,000 members that we have. And I've sent out emails and asked people to weigh in on this, and very few come back. But when they do come back, it's often this story. Somebody who's had a place for a long time, the property taxes, I mean, I don't know if you know, but cabins have had double-digit property tax increases consistently since 2001.
Now, Mr. Forrester, I'm very aware. I receive your emails.
Oh, okay.
We've had a cabin in our family for over 57 years.
I guess I'm singing to the choir then.
And by the way, your Appendix H, which has your concerns, was also in our packets. It's the very last page, and it's very interesting. I wanted to say something about, and I underlined here in your comments, and you also used this phrase, friends, family, or acquaintances. So I don't think that Senator Scogin's language would in any way affect that. I know we used to ask our cousins to help pay for the electricity when they used our cabin.
And there's a lot of that, but, you know, like somebody's going out of town for a week or two and they put their place up, you know, say, well, I'll rent my place. You know, somebody in Tower, which is where my family's from, and they advertise it in the Tower News. You know, or the Timber Jay. Well, now all of a sudden, for 1 week, or for maybe for deer season, or, you know, people in Minneapolis or St. Paul that thought to clear out when the Republican National Convention was, and they rented their place. Well, now all of a sudden they're lodging.
Well, and, you know, and that's an interesting point, because actually Hennepin County is one of the counties that does regulate vacation home rentals to some degree. I saw St. Louis on here, but it's really just by township. So I was going to tell Ms. Anderson that it's by, if there's any regulation, it's being done by the townships. Well, anyway, Mr. Forrester, I didn't want to interrupt you, and we kind of need to move on, so I want you to feel free to finish here.
Well, I mean, I guess I have, I had the addendum, and I guess that's our point, really, sure. Is I can see the need for the law, but this definition strikes me as too narrow, and I think there's room for both.
Before Ms. Anderson talked, I was thinking of the kind of, you know, what would ever get me to, like, rent our cabin to, you know, to somebody I didn't know. Or to, well, you know, we don't actually rent it. We've never charged anybody to stay there. And I'm thinking that people who have had cabins for a while, or maybe people who bought one in recent years plan to retire there but aren't really able to use it yet may rent it and take care of some
of
the expenses.
Or a lot of people who, Madam Chair, a lot of
Mr.
people
Mr.
who
Forrester.
Bought these places were living on dividend income and now find themselves with something that they can't carry.
Yeah, no, and Mr. Forrester, I understand that. So,
and I'm getting frantic emails. You know, I mean, there's there are people in that category now that are really, you know, and nothing, you know, I mean, you know, what is the forfeiture rate, you know, on like Lake Vermilion or something, or what will it be soon, or, you know, I mean, it's people are in tough spot right now, a lot of them.
That's right. So I'm guessing you'll see more of it in these, you know, last year, this year, maybe next, where people are doing it just because of the property taxes or because they can't, they had to take a second job and can't get there on weekends or whatever it is.
It's certainly not as a business that they've entered into, and this is their income, and this is a business.
Yeah, that's the challenge here, I think, to identify that where people intend to earn an income of some level. I mean, not necessarily primary, but of some sort. So we appreciate the work you do. I read all your emails.
Oh,
thank you.
Thank you. Somebody does.
Yeah, I do. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. I'll be brief. My name is Bill Griffith. I'm representing the Minnesota Vacation Rental Association. And what's interesting about our group is we kind of bridge the metro and non-metro areas. We have many of our members are right here in the metropolitan area, and then several of our members are in greater Minnesota. And so it's kind of an up north and city thing at both at the same time. I just want to make a couple of points that I think are germane to the discussion. I appreciate that this is the beginning of the discussion and not the end tonight. But I think it's important to note that we have no problem with reasonable regulation. Our deference would be that regulation should be at the local level. We believe there's inspection, health codes, rental licensing that can all occur at the local level, and we don't need to recreate the regulatory scheme that exists there. And we've actually have some experience in that. One of the most important points is that, in our view, this doesn't level the playing field. It takes one party off the field, and I'll explain that. Colleen Tollefson of Explore Minnesota stated, I think correctly, that many or most of these vacation rentals are in residential areas. And so when you graft on a business classification to what is essentially a residential use, you eliminate probably 80% to 90% of those rentals. And that's what we've experienced in the city of Minneapolis. We have an ongoing discussion now with the city of Minneapolis about reasonable regulations to define the vacation rental use. But if you graft on a business use classification by calling it a lodging establishment, you essentially eliminate that use in a residential area, because most cities do not allow for business uses in residential areas. And so that's one of our main concerns. The second concern is that if you start treating something that is essentially a short-term rental, it's no different than renting an apartment or a house. It happens to be on a short-term basis. If you start treating that as lodging, you miss the fact that we don't have swimming pools. We don't have areas open to the public. We don't have food handling. This is essentially a private party contract to rent on a short-term basis. And so we have a concern that grafting on the lodging definition not only eliminates most of these uses, but it also is inappropriate, and it doesn't really address the main issue, which can be addressed at the local level through zoning, through housing code, and through health code regulations.
Mr. Griffith, did you participate in the study group that undertook this report?
Madam Chair, we did not, because we're a new organization, and we really arise out of a great deal of interest at the local level in addressing this type of use. And so we're participating in the city of Minneapolis. We certainly would participate in a model ordinance discussion through the League of Minnesota Cities or otherwise, but we really think that putting this use on the same playing field as lodging really misses the point. We don't have those public facilities that a lodging establishment typically has. And so we're happy to be at the table tonight. We were not at the discussion a year ago because we didn't exist as an association. So we really grow out of this interest in defining the use and properly regulating it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I was just going to comment that, you know, in general, when it comes to some of these really difficult and touchy regulation issues, that this may not be a uniform statement for all the people who work that I've had contact with in local government, but often I've been asked as a state legislature to do the difficult job of figuring this out, as opposed to expecting at the county level each county to have to address what's really a statewide issue. So I would just say that, and that sometimes it's harder to have, you know, that this is probably something where it's a good idea to have some uniformity. And then the other thing I was going to say is that the idea of the zoning, you know, issue and wanting to have residential areas be residential is maybe the point that some of these people are having, is that they don't want something that is operating like a business to be in their residential area, where typically there are families with ownership interests and some they know each other and they have some sense of loyalty and community that is absent when you have a business type of thing going on.
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator.
Yes, Mr. Griffith.
I just, if I may respond, most of our owners, virtually all of our owners, do this on a occasional basis. They don't do it year-round. It's not something that's operated as a business. It's operated as your home. If you rented your home today to somebody on a 30-day basis or a, you know, multi-week basis, it's that type of rental. And what happens when you get a rental license is you have health, you have inspectors come in. They check for egress windows. They check for fire extinguishers. They check to make sure there isn't lead-based paint cracking in the bedrooms. And so those types of health regulations are there. I would say, though, most of the rentals that I've been to on a vacation basis probably wouldn't pass ADA code. And that's a concern, because how are you going to retrofit cabins and apartments and condos for ADA code? But people can self-select an accessible unit if that's what they want to do. The units are marketed as accessible. So,
and Senator Olson, and you certainly can follow it up, but and that's where we are probably not going to tread on those issues. Yes. Here in this committee. I don't know, Senator Olson, if you wanted, I don't want to keep that piece of the conversation going too long, but
no, Madam Chair, I was just going to follow up quickly on something that was said here, and I think this is what makes it a hard issue, is because back in my district, at least, we have that whole broad spectrum. From what I'm hearing, there are quite a few people who do own properties that are being rented. Yeah. Either, you know, that's what they're doing. They're doing it as a business. And then there are people who are occasionally maybe gone for 2 weeks, and this is going to help them pay their taxes. You know, so I think there's a broad spectrum.
Oh, you're right.
Part of that discussion, Senator Olson, will be when do you cross the line from running a business, even a part-time one or a small one, to just being an occasional renter? Mm-hmm.
And the tax code may help us with that, for example. That will be guidance. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson's comment about state regulation as opposed to state uniformity, the health department asked me, is the health committee chair, to offer an amendment that I think Senator Scogin's bill, I'm not intending this as a hostile amendment or anything. I think that the intent of the group was to make sure that by putting in this definition that would take care of the regulation under Chapter 157, and it does not. So I feel funny saying that this is a small, not purely technical, but small amendment that's 6 pages long to a 4-line bill. But I have the A1 amendment, and I'm not the expert in it. It does plug in the things that would need to go along. In other words, just putting a definition in the chapter doesn't make it happen, but it's an attempt to incorporate that, and I'm assuming health department was involved in the discussions. And I wanted to say one other thing that doesn't seem to be health department, seems more tax exempt, is the last section of Section 4, which is exemptions. Even though I think it's probably more appropriate in the tax code, there's a paragraph here to deal with what I saw in the report and what Ms. Tollefson said about exempting people who donate one time, here, add a licensing exemption for one donation annually for eligible charitable donations of weekend stays or periods of week or less for fundraising. That language is on the back of the bill, but I did have a question for either Senator Scogin or Ms. Tollefson or somebody who is on the task force. I'm assuming from the language there that the intent was that a homeowner could only donate one stay per year. The language here sort of implies that the charitable organization could only offer one donation a year, and I know some charitable organizations have silent auctions and they have three or four of them. I assume I don't know that there's a reason to limit to one donation a year either, but I don't want to get involved in this fight. I know you guys are trying to, it's a very tense issue. I would suggest maybe a couple for any person to donate, but certainly if the intent is not to pin it down so the charitable organization can only limit one, I have an amendment that I'd like to incorporate into this to accomplish that. So could I get comments from you or Ms. Dolphson or
Mr. Carlson?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Marty. Just so the committee is aware, the amendment is the conforming language that is contained in the vacation rental home report. We do not oppose the amendment. It wasn't necessarily our amendment to offer. And I remember specifically, I was on the task force, Senator Marty, and I specifically remember the Department of Revenue talking about this one-time donation and not triggering the tax issue. And I want to say, and I stand to be corrected, but I believe that the language in here is IRS compliant for donation of property for income tax purposes. So I'm happy to change that along the way, but I'm pretty sure that as we talk through this, that there was an IRS component to that, that this is compliant with.
Madam Chair,
Senator Marty.
Based on Mr. Carlson's comments, I won't change it from one donation per year from the owner, but I do have some language I'd like to incorporate so that a charitable group could get you to donate your cabin and Senator Scogin to donate one and somebody else to donate. So we might be giving three or four things at a large organization's auction, but no one property owner could donate more than once a year. You don't have a problem,
Mr.
with
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and members, we believe that on 6.19, where they may accept donations from private property owners, is plural, and that the singular is listed to the donator. But we're happy to clean that language up.
I'd like to incorporate some
language
to clarify that.
Madam Chairman, I was working with Senator Marty on this a bit, and the suggestion would be after donation on line 6.23, insert to that organization by that property owner.
We accept that, Madam Chair.
Okay. So, Senator Marty will incorporate that into his A1 amendment. And I think otherwise what's happening here is that vacation home rentals will now fit into the regulation. They're worked into where there are fees and what else do we have here? The licensing and the fees. And so then is 157, though that's the same chapter, so there is no tax thing in here yet, but there are fees, so.
They're not new fees.
Pardon me?
Madam Chair, that last paragraph probably more appropriately fits in the tax code than here.
Yeah.
But we can. That would be more a tax committee issue.
Is there any discussion on this? I think we're still working. I mean, and I think that this probably is a health committee decision, but it really does still have to come to you, Senator Marty. I want your committee to weigh in on whether or not they think that's important for public health to do that. But I do want to say that I think we need to deal with Mr. Forrester's and Ms. Anderson's concern that this occasional rental does not mean you're in the business of, you know, trying to earn some income doing this. Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, I think that's a good point. Frankly, I picture people like you who have a cabin and who loan it to rent it rent-free to friends and relatives once in a while. We just as soon keep it all honest, and if somebody is going to do it, well, okay, because you're using all this stuff, we'll pay you $400 for the week or something, and something that is basically a rent of some sort of thing. Yeah, I think we'd rather keep it honest that way, so some sort of way to deal with that exemption might be appropriate. I don't know. That's probably more tax committee than this committee or my committee.
We used to get about $10 for a week for electricity. That was it. That's when we were having a hard time paying the electric bill, can I say. years ago. But,
Madam Chair,
yes,
we've taken about a half hour more than we had
we
hoped.
Are.
We've
got we are.
About, we do have some people that would still like to say something, but that's your
it's
call.
Got to be really brief. Can feel free.
Brevity will be blessed. So,
welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, committee members. I appreciate being here. My name is Bill Weller. I live in Woodbury, Minnesota. And I want to bring a maybe a little bit different perspective. I make a living managing single-family homes as rental properties, and I manage both long-term rentals, which I think by definition we would say is 30 days or more, and I manage short-term rentals, which we would classify as 2 days or less than 30 days. And all of the properties that I manage are currently already regulated by cities or by counties. I am inspected already. I'm on an annual basis, pay a fee. The septic system and the water is tested so that the facilities are safe for the visitors and guests that come there. The bedrooms have egress windows or fire extinguishers and so forth. And I'm just wondering, do we need more regulation? Since it's already there, the cities, the counties already have in place the codes and the enforcement process, why do we need to add another layer of bureaucracy to this business or to this system of renting? When I buy a house, along with that house comes a bundle of rights. One of those rights I have when I buy this single-family house, whether I live in it or rent it, is that I can rent the property. And I think that's well recognized across the state. There are tens of thousands of single-family homes on lakes in cities being rented today. And they are governed by city ordinance, county ordinance already. And if there's a problem, all that person has to do, the neighbor, is call the police department, and that will be taken care of. Why do we need to add all of this language and bureaucracy to an already well-working situation? These vacation rentals that you call them or short-term rentals have been around as long as this state's been here. The only reason we're here today is because of the Internet. The Internet has enabled those people that want to rent these homes to find the customers, and they're there on an economical, easy basis. That's why we're here. It's an emerging new type of benefit to our community. Let me ask you a question. I have two houses here. This is a four-bedroom. There's two parents, four kids, and a grandparent living here, and it's rented on a more than 30-day basis. We'll call it a long-term rental. This house is a four-bedroom. Also, it's rented for less than 30 days, a weekend or a week or whatever you want to say, 28 days. There's four children, two parents and a grandparent here. In this home, there's two to four cars, depending on how old the kids are. In this home, there may be two to four cars. There's a certain amount of traffic. The kids go to volleyball games. They go to this and that. These houses are identical. There is no difference in the use of the house in this neighborhood. These are just people visiting from another community. Why do we need to single this house out as, quote, a vacation rental? It's already defined by Minnesota law, by community law, by city law. I'm not sure why we need to go down this road
at
all.
Mr. Weller, excuse me. We really don't. It's not regulated across the state uniformly. And I contend that the short-term rental is not the same. I think it has an impact on a community if you now have 2, 4, 6, 7 of those houses on a block that couldn't sell and now they're being rented. I'll tell you, that's a big issue in the community. The two communities I represent, we have, we're up from like 800 or 900 rentals, single-family rentals, up to 1,500 right now. And it's because, and it's doing things to neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. It's changing neighborhoods. And so I think people do have a concern, and I think I can differentiate, but I don't think that you're renting those homes as vacation homes, and I think this is pretty...
Yes, I am. I'm definitely. I'm on the Internet. They advertise, just like this home, I advertise on the internet for long-term rentals. I get a call from a renter. I screen them. I have an agreement, written agreement. Same thing here. It's exactly the same.
And they're on vacation, but their kids are in the volleyball team. And I mean,
well,
I don't.
No, they're going to restaurants. They're going to the Mall of America. There's different activities. But I'm just saying this is a residential use. This is a residential use. It doesn't change the character of the neighborhood at all. And your opinion is different, and I respect that.
So, Senator Prettner-Solin.
Madam Chair, I think, Mr. Willers, you're probably fortunate you don't live in my community of Duluth, where if you own a home, if you own a home that's within 300 yards of a home that's rented, you do not have the right, and you have to license to rent. You don't have the right to rent your property.
Wow. Okay, that's interesting.
Well,
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, briefly, the Congress of Minnesota Resorts appreciates all the time you've taken on this issue and the amount of the fee and the number of times of rental and not duplicating regulatory efforts. I think we're happy to deal with as this bill moves forward. I know Bill Straczynski would like to say something, and I just want to say we appreciate all the time you've given to this issue.
Okay. Senator Marty would like to move the amendment with that incorporated language. And I'm going to ask the committee to vote on that if there's any discussion on that particular amendment. The A1. And you have a copy of it, Senator Scogin.
Yes.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. So now the bill has been amended with this language. Ma'am, would you like to speak to us?
Yes. Yes, I would. My name is Doris Runa, and I live in southwest Minneapolis.
How do you spell your last name?
R-U-N-A. It's like tuna with an R.
Okay.
It's been that way since grade school.
Welcome.
I've lived in the house we have on Minnehaha Parkway for 25 years, my husband for 30. In 1998, we are a vacation rental owner. And we do run it as a business. So I hope to give you a unique perspective of, and we're working with the city of Minneapolis as well, as to how to do it correctly, okay? But in 1998, we purchased the house next door. And we purchased it first with the concept of having the in-laws retire there, take care of them. And they decided not to move to Minnesota, but to California. So
imagine that.
Yeah. So with that, what we did is we put about $100,000 worth of improvements into it at that time in 1998 dollars, not too bad. And what ended up is we ended up renting it in a niche market of international families who are here with corporations for 2 to 3 years. So what happened is that, you know, we are in a wonderful neighborhood. We have wonderful neighbors. And the house now is valued at $575. The one in back is $1.5. I mean, you know,
it's
not
a nice neighborhood.
It's a nice neighborhood. Yes. It's residential. And then from the beginning, when we purchased it and then said, you guys, you just had a wine party and said, we're going to rent it out. What does the neighbors think? Everybody trusts us. They know us. And so what we did, again, put about $100,000 in. Rented first to a family from Sweden who are here for 3 years. And a key thing, whenever you deal with international families, they come with their suitcases and some pictures. And that means you have to furnish from the towels to the, you know, every single piece of furniture, every sheet, every towel, glass, silverware. And we went high end because we did not, back in 98, it was $2,700 a month, okay? So it was meant that it is not a cheap place, and it's a very nice place. So we've done very well with international families, a family from Sweden, a family from Chile, a family from Australia, and one from the UK. And again, at the time where it was kind of, corporations, I mean, with money tightening up, we had a local family that came to us saying, we need a place to live for a period of time. We just had a fire in the house. It's going to take us about 6 months to fix it. Bottom line to that is that they moved in, and we ended up asking them to leave. So I'm giving this aspect is that we've done both long-term and now we're doing short-term. We had to ask this family to leave because, as my husband said, it was one step up from a garbage house. These are two professional people that we then ended up having to put another $30,000 into it. So to fix it up. And my husband then said, let's sell it. But this is why I'm giving you the background, is that how we made the transition into short-term rental. We put it on the market. Former neighbors who were now living in Phoenix contacted us, asking us to rent it for 2 weeks. When they were there, by the way, it was neighbors who informed them that the house is on the market, and they said, talk to Doris and Greg. Maybe you can rent it short-term. It's fully furnished. So we did. When they were there, we talked to them. We found out every year this family goes to vacationrental byowner.com to find a single-family house in a different city around the U.S. so they can experience that city. They wanted a residential aspect. So when they were there, we got all the information from them, talked to the neighbors, and then signed up for vacationrental byowner.com. And please note that the bottom line is that people who have their properties on that, there is a specific checklist of what to do. And that what that checklist is, okay, you get an inquiry. People who are interested, they have to do a $500 security deposit. They have to sign a short-term rental agreement. There's very specific things that we have to do, and we do it correctly. So we don't have raucous parties. We don't have situations like that. What we have is usually a lot of families in town, extended families, who are in town for about a week for a family wedding. They don't want to do hotels. This is people who are coming to the metro, and they want the family all to be together. And again, it's that. Last week we had a family who was in town, extended family, and they were helping the mother of the new grandchild that came into the family. Today we had a family coming in from Canada. And
Because we've got a lot of bills, are you almost finished?
Yes, I've got about maybe a minute and a half. Okay. I'm trying to give a different perspective because you've been hearing cabins. This is in the city. These are and so the definition, it's a broad spectrum. What happens on Minnehaha Parkway in Minneapolis is so different than the cabins on a lake. We do use it as a business. We are licensed. We pay a fee. We pay our taxes. We pay taxes on that property. So we're doing everything correctly. So if we could figure out a way that this definition as it is does lump us into a definition that maybe is not helpful or appropriate for us. All I know is that the neighbors are happy with us. It's been successful for us, and we've been happy bringing people into the city of Minneapolis to have an enjoyable stay and bring in dollars. But that's it from a different perspective, and we will continue to work with the city of Minneapolis to make sure that it is the licensing that they're requesting for this will be done properly.
Okay. Thank you. It is important we look at that perspective. Mr. Straczynski, very briefly.
Mr. Chairman, members of this committee, I'm Bill Straczynski, and I'm here representing the interests of Breezy Point Resort. I'm sure many of you are familiar with it. The bill before you tonight, with the amendment that's been adopted, really creates some pretty horrendous problems for Breezy Point Resorts. You must understand that those of you, I'm sure you've been there, there's 13,000 different property owners within Breezy Point's complex, original 3,000 acres. We have timeshare, we have condominiums, we have vacation homes, everything. We have all the properties identified in this bill. Since 1964, I haven't lobbied for them that long, but I had to go back to the early 80s, but since 1964, Breezy Point has had timeshares, condominiums, vacation homes. They own some, others within the confines there. They rent them out to the public through their resort license. That's what they've been doing. They've been collecting the tax. Properties have been inspected, what have you. This changes the dynamic dramatically for Breezy Point Resort. It would say that individual owners have to get a license. Now you got 51 owners of one unit, one of timeshare interest in one building. You might have 20 units in there. You don't need 51 different licenses for the same unit or what have you. We'd like to, and I have been, and in truthfulness, I've been working with the Department of Health, meeting with them. We've had several meetings since last fall trying to come up with a definition that would work. so that Breezy Point can continue to operate the way it has. And there's other large resorts in Minnesota that do this as well. They're responsible that the first in the food chain to, with their license, vacation rentals are rented to them. They collect the fees and make sure they're safe places. This, we need a definition. We need an exemption or something or some kind of a definition which clearly allows them to continue to allow people who have a timeshare unit, a rental, or vacation home in the resort area there, right there, to rent through under the resort license so that we don't have to change our dynamic quite a bit. I must tell you, in fairness to all of us, I did meet with the Department of Health just last week. The proposal they had at least it would only require 26 new licenses in the future, but that's problematic for all of us in large resorts. So, Mr. Chairman and Senator Marty, I'd just like to say that I'm happy to work with Senator Scogin. I'd like to and need to because we want to continue to do what we've been doing since the 60s. We don't want to change the dynamic. We're paramount about public safety, health regulations. All the pools are inspected, jacuzzis, whirlpools. We care about the public health because we got to take care of our customers. But we have a lot of different kind of units coming in and out of our rental pools all summer long. We need those units, and we need to be able to operate those units under our master license for the resort as opposed to having to get individual licenses because they're different kinds of property. So we have a unique circumstance, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and I'll work with Senator Scogin, and hopefully we can get something worked out if the bill indeed goes to your committee, Senator Martin.
Mr. Szczesinski, I'm glad to hear you will work with Senator Scogin. I kind of wonder, it seems to me there'd be easy as an outsider to figure out that either you're covered by the resort definition already, which would exclude you from this, or I don't know if we timeshare should be separate. I don't know. I'm just saying that I know it's tough, and I know Senator Scogin's been trying to bring together everyone. I hope you'll keep working with him.
Mr. Chairman, we work with the resort industry and what have you. But you understand, if you've been to Breezy Point, you know but there are all those properties around there. When you go up there, most of those properties are owned by other people. They're owned by individuals. Breezy Point puts them into rental pool, and they rent them back out. Some of them they own themselves, some they don't. That's how they've been able to do it. That's how they built that business model over the years. We want to be able to continue to do that like we've been doing for lots of years within the license parameters we have. But we've got to – so, Mr. Chairman, that's our case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Szczesinski. Senator Scogin moves Senate File 894 as amended to be recommended to pass. And Senator Scogin, I think my committee is going to not be looking forward to getting this bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll put in a hearing request, and then it's up to you.
Well, we've got about 40 bills. Our staff is going to have a fit when they hear about this one. Having said that, Mr. Stang says this is our committee's jurisdiction. I'm hoping that with the Health Department amendment there that it won't take a lot of time there and that these other disputes in terms of what's a timeshare and what's other rental property and so on, I think some of those, they're not health issues, and I hope that between tax committee or wherever else it goes, that maybe somewhere along there the conversations can continue. I'm sure we'll see you in our committee soon. On that, Senator Scogin moves Senate File 894 as amended to be recommended pass, referred to the Committee on Health, Housing, and Family Security. Is there any further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. 2-1. 2-0.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Senator, are you ready?
Ready.
Senator Prettner-Solon, we'll take your bill up, perhaps.
Did we deal with that?
Oh, good. Good. I wasn't here.
By the time we get to mine, there'll be nobody here.
Well, we don't want it all. It took too long.
Yeah. At nighttime like this?
You can type it wrong, though.
When the sun's going
on? Over there once.
No, it's tax code work.
Yeah, it is.
It's fine. I'm not going to suffer.
I thought we were so close.
Senate File 525.
What does it down by six?
Bill looks familiar.
Oops. Mr. Chair, this bill passed out of the Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee 2 weeks ago, the Judiciary Committee last week, and now it's before the Commerce Committee. Tattooing is one of the fastest-growing industries in the United States. One successful tattooist could tattoo perhaps hundreds or thousands of people each year. Each of these people who receive a tattoo make a common assumption that the tattoo they receive is safe. A study released in July of 2003 by Scripps Howard News Service and Ohio University claims that one in seven adults has a tattoo. 88% personally know at least one who has a tattoo. Additionally, 30% of those in the 25 to 34-year age group and 28% of those under 25 are tattooed. These numbers show that tattooing is not a passing fad. It is on weekly television shows and is a multi-billion-dollar industry. Yet in Minnesota, there is no regulation regarding the application of tattooing. The licensure of tattoo artists, the inspection of tattoo shops, or recourse against unethical operators. Possible side effects of a suboptimal tattoo procedure include antibiotic-resistant staph infection and hepatitis C. In Minnesota, there are regulations and licensing for haircutting. There are regulations and licensing for massage. Tattooing, however, which comes into contact with biohazardous material, has no standard regulation or licensing in Minnesota. This bill came about when a constituent who has worked in the tattoo industry brought these concerns to my attention. His name is Ryan Wells, and he has been an advocate for the past few years for tattoo application regulation in Minnesota. Using models such as Oregon State Tattoo Regulation and Minnesota's Hennepin County Regulation, Mr. Wells has worked with other tattooists to create a state regulation that protects artists and clients. In addition to having input from tattooists in Duluth, Hibbing, St. Paul, and Stillwater, he has sought input from Sean Anderson from the Alliance of Professional Tattooists, Hennepin County Public Health Officials, the League of Minnesota Cities, the Red Cross, and Memorial Blood Banks. As a leader in their field, Mr. Wells and the tattooists he has been working with are asking for responsible state policy of licensure and regulation. This is an opportunity for the state legislature to work with the tattoo industry proactively. However, due to his work schedule, Mr. Wells was unable to be here today, so I will walk through the provisions of the bill. So, Section 1 outlines definitions. Section 2 relates to facility regulation. And this covers the licensing of the tattoo shop, temporary events, and record-keeping requirements for the tattoo shop. This is essential to controlling and creating a work area to prevent cross-contamination, protect clients from exposure to blood-borne pathogens, equipment sterilization, and disposal of biohazard material. These records aid in researching complaints and inspection. Section 3 covers the educational requirements of the individual artist. Section 4 relates to guest artists and apprenticeships. This provision covers the educational requirements of the individual artist. Section 5 outlines grounds for closure and creates clear enforcement for violation of law. Section 6 deals with facility requirements, equipment requirements such as single-use needles and equipment sterilization, best practices for application of tattoos, best practices for tattooists and biohazard disposal and storage. Section 7 relates to consent and standard practice. And this covers the requirements that need to be met to receive a tattoo and the necessary steps to ensure consent and age verification. Also included are the requirements for client records. Section 8 deals with investigation and enforcement. It covers the obligations and procedures for reporting violations to the commissioner, as well as requirements for reinstatement after correcting cited items. Section 9 contains language that this bill will not preempt counties or municipalities. Section 10 outlines fees for technicians and establishments. And finally, Section 11 establishes an effective date of August 1st, 2009. Is that correct? Yes. And while Mr. Wells was unable to attend today, I do have some other folks with me today. However, first I do have an amendment, the A2 amendment.
Yes, it's being distributed right now. Is this a technical amendment? I know Ms. Kavanagh.
Well, it reflects some changes that Hennepin County and the constituent brought to me and agreed on. And the main changes there are that if an establishment is licensed by a municipality, the establishment does not have to be licensed by the state if the provisions of the ordinance meet or exceed the provisions of this bill. Also, there's a requirement that the commissioner inspects an establishment during construction and during remodeling, as well as at the time of the initial license and upon renewal. However, it also states that those that... Let me find this. Those establishments that have been in... that have been there as of August 1st, 2009, are exempt from health and safety standards that are required under the first subdivision if they that would require them to remodel. So they're not required to remodel. So I would move the A2 amendment.
Senator Pretner, someone moves the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Tuberculosido. I never heard of that word before. I can figure out what it means, but I had never seen it before.
I think that it's something that prevents or...
Tuberculosis. Kills tuberculosis.
Probably. But anyways, probably Dr. Elizabeth Perry can tell you. She's from the Memorial Blood Banks, and I also have Vic Moore, who represents the Red Cross. Both would like to make some brief comments and answer any questions.
Yes, because the other committees went through this fairly extensively. And but welcome to the committee, Dr. Perry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, Memorial Blood Center supports the licensing of tattoo establishments in the state of Minnesota. Approval of this legislation puts us in step with the almost 50% of states that have enacted this legislation. We support this in two independent ways, by ensuring establishments follow proper precautions. It diminishes the risk of transmission of bloodborne infectious diseases. While there are relatively few documented transmissions in Minnesota attributable to tattooing, with the growing popularity of the procedure, maintaining control can help ensure the transmission rate remains extremely low. Second, in the blood banking industry, there are specific requirements to defer blood donation for a year following tattooing in the absence of licensing by the state. The American Association of Blood Banks, now known as the AABB, requires a 12-month deferral for tattooing by any entity that is not approved by a state. With an aging population and growing demand for blood, we need to ensure that we are not unnecessarily losing our future donors. Tattooing disproportionately defers our younger donors, and we put our future blood supply at risk by deferring these donors. Once a prospective blood donor has been deferred, it is unusual for them to return to donate again. So if you have an 18-year-old who's been deferred for a tattoo, it's unlikely that he or she will return to support the ever-increasing needs of our aging population. Thank you for your opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Dr. Perry. Mr. Moore.
Mr. Chair, I'm Vic Moore. I represent the American Red Cross, and I'll be very brief. This bill would literally free up thousands of blood donors. As Dr. Nolan has told you, in Minnesota now, under current standards, you have to wait a year if you've had your body pierced with a tattoo or other body piercing. There are two key provisions in this bill that would free that up so that blood donors could give on a more regular basis and give quicker. One of those is the use of sterile single-use needles. and the other one is satisfactorily completing a course in bloodborne pathogens. Those are fundamental to the being able to speed up the process and not wait for a year to donate blood. And the problem multiplies because many times a blood donor, once turned down, doesn't come back. So it's cyclical. So we really support this legislation. We're in dire need of getting more donors and getting more blood. And if you pass this legislation, it'll be very helpful to the American Red Cross.
Thank you. Senator Prittner, so I move Senate File 525 as amended be recommended pass. Is there a discussion on that? Is there anybody else who needed to speak to the bill? Okay, we have more people. Go ahead, please.
Face to me. My name's Elizabeth McCullough. Nice to meet you.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself, and we appreciate brevity because the committee has got some more work yet, too. So.
Gotta help me. I'm hard of hearing.
You want to go first?
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, great. Hey, listen, I'm hard of hearing, so that's okay. But please be patient with me and ask, like, Beth or something so I could hear you. If you have any questions, that would be great. All right. I know that there's blood bank people here. I didn't hear all of what they said, but I do have some stuff on that a little bit later. All right? First of all, my name is Tanika Nolan, owner and operator of Acme Tattoo Company, along with husband Don Nolan. We have been in business for 21 years, tattooed thousands of people over the years. My husband, Don Nolan, has tattooed for over 55 years. Myself, 19. These are only a few of my challenges due to not being informed of this law until last minute and have not had proper time to look them over so that it safeguards the industry and protects the public. Tattooing of minors. The proposed law overlooks an issue that I feel strongly about. The tattooing of minors. Currently, a minor may obtain a tattoo if he or she has written permission from a parent. Most of the complaints I hear about involve the tattooing of minors. I believe that the proposed law should require that tattoo artists cannot tattoo or pierce or do any body work on children under age 18. It is too easy for a minor to fake a written permission slip from a parent. This problem could be avoided by simply raising the legal age to get a tattoo to 18. It is not clear that a release signed by a minor is enforceable. Generally, any contract signed by a minor is voidable and may be voided when the minor attains the age of 18. Generally, children under age 18 do not have sufficient judgment to make a decision about body art that will be with them the rest of their lives. Children under 18 skin is not even growing yet, including the earlobes, which is an unregulated service, which should be regulated. Children do not need tattoos, and the law should prohibit the tattooing of minors. The proposed law is anti-competitive. It makes it very easy for licensed tattoo artists to prevent others from joining the profession. Essentially, in order for an aspiring tattoo artist to obtain a license, under the proposed law, they must find a tattoo artist and ask to become an apprentice. Am I too loud for you? Okay, great. Thank you. Most tattoo artists will refuse because they do not want to make it easy for someone else to go into competition with them. Some tattoo artists might offer to sell the apprenticeship and say that they will only accept an apprentice if the apprentice pays an exorbitant amount of money. There are no other professions where the ability to obtain a license is under the direct control of people actively earning their income from the profession. The proposed law imposes unnecessary requirements. Sink. Water is not used in the tattooing process. The requirement that in addition to a sink and a restroom, a tattoo shop have an additional sink in the tattooing area. It is not reasonably related to tattoo safety, and it is unnecessary. Alcohol-based hand sanitizer is an approved method by health departments all over. for sanitizing your hands. Foam in, foam out. It's in hospitals everywhere. Hospital operating rooms do not have sinks in them because gases and germs can come up through the plumbing. The requirement for an unnecessary second sink imposes a financial burden on smaller tattoo shops that will have to install a second sink. The requirement for an unnecessary second sink makes it less likely that tattoo shops will be able to find space to rent. A second sink in a public area will require build-out that a landlord may not want to pay for or authorize. Dimensions of work area. The requirement that a tattoo work area be 45 square feet is not reasonably related to tattoo safety. This requirement would make it necessary for many existing tattoo shops to relocate. Partition of work area. The requirement that work areas be partitioned is not reasonably related to tattoo safety. There is no evidence that the requirement of a sink, a 45 square foot work area, or a partition of work area leads to greater tattoo safety. These requirements impose a financial burden on the tattoo industry. Almost every township and city are regulated by a health department. And they have pretty much what Senator Tholen has in her bill. So it's already being taken care of at a city and township level. If the state wants to do something for safety, please pass the law to not tattoo children or pierce them or any bodywork under the age of 18, per New Hampshire law, which states it's under child endangerment for endangering the child of a welfare, which holds a felony. That would be great to do. Along with my past laws that I've attempted to do with trying to do the 18-year-old law, HF 690 has been through several times, which you can look up. As far as with the blood bank, I'm sorry I didn't hear what you said. I've done some research on this. First of all, in New York in the 1950s, hepatitis broke. Hepatitis.
Can you address the committee? We're not trying to persuade the blood bank. We're trying to decide if this is good legislation for us.
You have to talk to the committee. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I talked to them now. Okay, thanks.
You can talk with her later about it. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm sorry. Anyways, in New York City in the 1950s, hepatitis had broke out. And there wasn't sterilizing at that point in time. So what they did is they banned tattooing in New York City. A little later, they found out that it came from a hospital. Since then, sterilizing is mandated. If you are under jurisdiction of a regulated health department, you can write off and sign off that you use a sterilizer. You have spore testing, outside spore testing. You can give blood. Evidence of transfer of bloodborne pathogens from body art. I am unable to find any current or prior medical documentation of transfer of bloodborne pathogens between clients caused by tattoos. If such evidence exists, I would ask that it be provided for our review. Proponents of SF-525 have here today members of the blood bank to discuss the rules of the blood donation and recent body adornment. However, it is unclear to me how implementation of this legislature will change the established rules of privately established blood bank organizations. Clearly, individuals with non-healed wounds, illnesses, or taking certain medications are not ideal candidates for blood donation. By implementing SF-525, the government isn't going to change the privately established guidelines of blood donation organizations. This is an irrelevant argument that is based on personal opinion. It does not provide any documented evidence that can be used as the basis of an informed decision. I look forward to working with you and the industry. Thank you, and make it a great night. Thanks.
Sam, please go ahead.
Question?
Elizabeth McCullough, and I have been tattooing at Acme Tattoo for about 13 years. And we recently became aware of the legislation that you're looking at, and I did a little calling around to find out, because the physical requirements being specified in the bill don't necessarily match those of our tattoo shop or several others that I'm familiar with. And I know that we've been incident-free for over 20 years, and so I kind of began to question, like, maybe there was a trend. And having called several health departments, beginning with the Minnesota Department of Health, which has no position but also has no records of complaints or incident, and the Minnesota Public Health, which also had no record of incident associated with tattooing or piercing. Then went on and I called Ramsey, Anoka, Hennepin, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the trend was there was no incident of problems in the tattooing or piercing on a technical aseptic level, but I did hear of some complaints concerning underage piercing and tattooing. 1 and 05 and 07, both instances in St. Paul, and then additionally Anoka. Their health department indicated that whenever they had a call or a complaint, it also involved the tattooing or piercing of a minor. I also called St. Louis County because I was curious, because the legislation was coming from there. And I'm aware that there are three shops in Duluth, and the St. Louis County Health Department had no official stance on the legislation, but they did say that it was a low priority on their needs assessment. And in addition, when I called the St. Louis Sheriff's Department, they had no complaint. I mean, the Health Department in St. Louis County had no complaints concerning tattooing or piercing. And then the Sheriff's Department did have one incident in 06 pertaining to the tattooing of a minor. So I guess what I would like the committee to think about is that most of the trend in terms of tattooing is that the problem is arising with the tattooing or piercing of minors, and it's not something that's arising out of the establishment layout, the training of the tattooist, or the aseptic technique when we talk about sterilization, hand washing, foam in, foam out, that kind of thing. And in regards to the blood bank, this legislation that's being proposed is already in effect in Minneapolis to lesser and greater degrees. There's like 250 licenses that are managed by Hennepin, Anoka, Ramsey, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. So the major metro area is already licensed and regulated. A lot of the outstate counties, as you start moving further out, they've also adopted legislation in order to regulate this type of activity. Isanti, Sherburn, Washington, they all have regulation. Rochester and Olmsted, they're a pretty large metro area or, you know, population. They do not. Moorhead does. So I guess what I'm trying to point out is that this is being handled for the vast majority of the Minnesota population by the city and county governments at this time. And I think in terms of the blood bank issue, there's a real big pool of people that they could get out of the University of Minnesota, or, for that matter, we could do blood drives at the tattoo shops. Those that are regulated would probably be more than happy to line up their people. But I just wanted to state that. I think it's relevant. I think that the legislation that's going forward is already being dealt with at a city and a county level. Thank you.
Thank you. One comment in response to the testimony, I was going to say that I think her amendment makes it clear that local regulation, I think she pointed out, exempts, if it's stricter than the state regulation, that is sufficient and you don't need the state regulation for those communities. So this would only apply in places where there is no, or there's weaker regulation locally. And also it does exempt remodeling any existing establishments from the code things related to square foot and so on. But Senator Prettner-Sowen, did you have any response or any other comments you wanted to make? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that each of the comments that were made are really were addressed in my testimony, and I'm not sure if you want me to reiterate that, but I think that they probably aren't aware that We have been working with Hennepin County. We're not preempting anything in Hennepin County or Anoka County, and this law is consistent. It just makes it uniform across the state, and that anybody who has been licensed as of August 1st, 2009, does not have to remodel their establishment, that they're exempt from the requirements of the facility.
Senator Pittner-Solin, did you wish to move the bill?
Yes.
Sir, did you want to speak briefly to it?
Briefly.
Very briefly. Go ahead.
I missed everything that was said.
Friend will tell you. Your friend can tell you.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, and the rest of the committee. Senator Pittner-Solin, my name is Sean Anderson. I own Electric Dragon Land in Hopkins, Minnesota. I've been there for 15 years. I'm a tattoo artist with over 22 years' experience, and I'm on the board of directors of the Alliance of Professional Tattooists. I've been a board member on this organization for 10 years, and I'm its immediate past president, a position I held for 4 years. About 3 years ago, Mr. Wells approached me in interest in passing some sort of law. Being on the board of directors of the Alliance of the Professional Tattooist, I am prohibited from participating in putting forward legislation statewide. Our bylaws prohibit me. Although, once legislation is imminent, I'm able to help out. I must stress that I've been given no position by the other shops in the state of Minnesota to speak for the industry as a whole. I'm here as just a concerned shop owner and professional, and I have great interest in making sure this law is written to serve the best interest of not only myself but my neighbors as well. I was made aware of the companion bill House File 677 that died in License Committee, I believe, last Friday, and I feel since I found out about the bill that Mr. Wells and at that time Representative Saitow, with great help from the people from Hennepin County Health Department, have made great efforts to work with the industry to make sure this bill not only serves the general public but the industry as well. They had showed great interest in continuing to work with the industry to produce a well-written law and have addressed most of my concerns of the bill. Other concerns that I've heard from the rest of the industry in Minnesota is they feel that more time may be needed to read and adjust certain wordings contained therein. Myself and other shop owners have great concern what the cost of licensure will be. Most of our shops are small. We are aware that state licensure would have a price tag attached, and at a time of short of funds, we're worried about what that license cost would be. With all these concerns that I have stated at this time, this bill in its amended form has my support, and I look forward to working with the Senate to ensure both the needs of the public and the needs of the legislature are met. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. And I know Senator Solin's been trying to work with people in the last year and a half, I think, we first saw this bill. So thank you for your testimony. Senator Pittner-Solin moves Senate File 525 as amended to be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Correct. Correct, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion on the motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion no. prevails.
Thank you.
Senator Gurley.
Ma'am, actually, you're not supposed to be up here. I can talk to you shortly. I'll come see you. Maybe outside the door, okay? We need to get going with this next bill, and I'll come see you.
No, not yet.
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah, yeah. That's why I said outside. The Roadrunner.
No birth announcement yet. If
nothing yet.
Was
okay, Senator Scogin.
I was getting worried.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and those brave souls. I'm wondering if I when I make the break, it's getting on the bubble of when I should call home and say goodnight to the kids. But I think we'll be okay here. The bill I have before you, in fact, I might as well, move the bill. I'll move Senate File 1539. It'd be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee.
And you have an amendment, I think you want. You have an author's amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. We might as well do those. Right now, actually, I have one written author's amendment, the A1 amendment, and also two oral amendments that are very simple as well.
Okay. We'll do the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. Okay. All those in favor of the A1, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Okay. Now, and Madam Chair, this bill's getting there. Now, you need to add... Do something else here?
Yes, Madam Chair. On the bill, two simple oral amendments on page 19, section 8, which is lines 24 through 30.
Yes.
Section 8 would like to delete section 8. I would make that motion, Madam Chair.
Do you want to do the other one as well? Is the other one a delete also? Or?
No, it is it is not a delete.
Okay. Member C, Senator Gerlach, is deleting Section 8. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
And, Madam Chair, the last oral amendment is two pages up on page 21. Lines 11 and 12 under the rescission section. First of all, on line 11, you'll see it says the earlier of 60 calendar days. We would strike 60 and insert 30.
Okay.
And on line 12, where it says executed by all parties or 30 calendar days, we need to strike 30 and insert 15. There's some modifications to the rescission section.
Okay, and on that amendment, members, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. That motion prevails. Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you then, Madam Chair. Now the bill is in shape. What I would like to say is that this is the Viatical Settlement Model Act, and if you're like me, you first said, well, what does viatical mean? And if you have not had Latin, then or any language, you could take a guess at it. I have not had Latin, but I guess that it had something to do with life, being via. And since this is the Commerce Committee, not the Health Committee, it probably had something to do with insurance. So if you guessed life insurance, you are on track.
Very good. Your analytic.
I'd like to put this in context to what we're doing, because we have dealt with some life insurance issues so far this year. And to make it simple and clear for members of the committee, if you would imagine that the life settlement issue is a pool of all these things we've been dealing with. Earlier this session, we dealt with the strange-originated life insurance issue. That was a piece of that. We also have a piece of life settlements called viatical settlements, and this is something that is currently regulated, and it is an area of life insurance a settlement that was really came out of a couple of decades ago, primarily, I understand, put forth by AIDS patients to be able to use their existing life insurance for treatments or for what they needed to do, and that this was put in place to help them to do that. But what we've seen, the good news is over time, is that the demand for that has diminished. But at the same time, more and more folks, as we've learned through the previous discussion on the topic of life settlements, that the secondary market for selling of life insurance for people who don't need it anymore as baby boomers age, that settlement has been, or that area has been growing. So this is a department bill. And the department is essentially taking the viatical settlement section of statute out, reworking it, recodifying it, adding in
life settlements, which we currently do not regulate, and come up with using this Model Act, a set of regulations so that we can handle the viatical along with the life settlements. This is not the STOLE issue that we have been dealing with earlier this session. This is about the other parts. I want to put that in context so that everybody understands, and I hope that's clear to everybody what we're doing and why, and that's why the language on the bill, you'll see it looks like all entirely new language. A lot of that is reworked, you know, of the pieces of the viatical statutes that were taken out, reworked and being put in. It's not all just something entirely new. So that is the context of which we bring this bill before you, and I will certainly admit to you that I am no expert in this area, which is why we have backup here, Mr. Robert Commodore for the Department of Commerce, who will be able to explain and answer any questions. We certainly don't need to go section by section on this bill. It is rather lengthy, but certainly to put it put everybody at ease as far as what is going on here. I have met with several members from the department and also the industries, both on the insurance industry side and the life settlement side, to try to come to what we can get or hear that will work. And you'll be hearing probably from some of them as well. But I think what we'll do, members, if you don't have any questions of me directly, is I'd like Mr. Commodore to speak a little bit about the bill.
And Senator Gerlach, thank you. And Mr. Commodore, just a moment. I wanted to ask you, I wasn't sure if I understood you to say, Senator Gerlach, that there is some, is there reference in here to life settlements agreements? Because those had not been regulated before, will be. Do you,
yes.
And so that is in here? Well, are they just I'll let Mr. Commodore.
Yes, maybe Mr. Commodore can explain exactly the
committee.
Detail.
Good evening.
Good evening, Madam Chair. Again, my name is Robert Commodore. I'm the Director of Investigations for the Department of Commerce.
And Mr. Commodore, before you go on, forgive me, Senator Prettner-Solon, did you have a question?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, or Mr. Commodore, why are we changing the term from life insurance to viaticals?
Chair and Senator Solon, we're not changing the name of life insurance. It's the. Are you talking about the life settlements?
Life settlement. Okay.
Madam Chair and Senator Solon, life settlement would be the arrangement, the transaction by which you have excess life insurance capacity or that you don't need, but yet you own it through private property, and the life settlement is a transaction by where you sell that to the secondary market. Okay. And a viatical is one specific type of that. And what we're doing is we're taking the viaticals, updating that, and adding in life settlements, which we currently don't regulate, and putting it all together. Does that help? Or maybe Mr. Commodore could explain.
Mr. Commodore, I think we'll listen to you for a little bit here and see
what. Well, it's hard to follow this act. I mean, he's been so good so far. let's recognize that the current Minnesota law does talk about viatical settlements. It's based upon a Model Act from 1993. The industry itself has changed greatly since that time. There have been some new Model Acts proposed by the NAIC that Minnesota has not taken the opportunity to bring to you before, and it is certainly time for us to do that at this point. The industry itself has changed, as Senator Gerlach has indicated, and I know that you've heard plenty of testimony already. The life settlement industry, which, again, the department does not oppose, and we do think it's a good thing, the life settlement industry has not been totally recognized in Minnesota law, and this bill repeals all the old law except for one section regarding fees and brings in the new language to bring into the to Minnesota all of the new statutes, model acts, and court cases that have been out there in recognizing the legitimacy of life settlement, but recognizing the need to bring some controls on that market. And that's what this bill is attempting to do. We're not changing anything great in the world. It's a very simple bringing in Minnesota statutes up to what the current marketplace is.
And Mr. Commodore, then a life settlement is a viatical settlement.
A viatical is a life settlement, yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, maybe
Senator
the Madam Chair, the viatical, correct me if I'm wrong, is a subset of life settlements.
Yes.
So it's not necessarily what
it's
you said.
It's one type of life settlement.
The definition of viatical settlement contracts includes life settlements.
So is it a subset of viatical is a subset of life settlements, or are life
viaticals
settlements a subset
are a subset of life settlements. It is one type of life settlement.
Okay.
The viaticals, as Senator Gerlach mentioned, came out of a crisis in the 90s with the AIDS, and it was focused on that, although the Life Settlement Association and industry had been around longer than that. The focus on that came as a result of AIDS, and that's where all of the state, the original Model Act and all the states acted at that time to regulate that part of it. And now the industry itself has been expanded because of the exposure under the for the AIDS patients, that being an option for anyone having a life policy became more exposed, and it's more prevalent at this time.
I'm still a little confused, because it looks to me like the life settlement agreement would be a kind of viatical settlement, but that's how I see it.
I
don't see life settlement even mentioned in here.
It's not. Madam Chair, I understand your confusion, and we have been working with industry to try and look at some of the terms. Again, our intention was to bring in the Model Act, delete our present definitions and bring in the Model Act, which still use the term viatical settlements. But we have been working with industry, and we are certainly willing to change some of those terms from viatical to life settlement in recognition of that. We did not have enough time to present that for you today, but that is something that we have been working with industry about, and I think that will help you all. But it is very – I want you to be very clear that that is what this is all about.
So, Senator Prettner-Solon.
So, Madam Chair and Mr. Commodore, is this a restatement of current law, or are there substantial changes in here?
Mr. Commodore.
It's a restatement of current Model Acts with a couple tweaks, including the amendments that we just made to reflect current industry practices.
Okay. Members, do you have other
questions? It's primarily based upon the NEIC Model Act.
Senator Scogin.
Madam Chair, this way beyond my pay grade, but I mean, we're even repealing unfair trade practices and things. Is this typical?
That may be a function of the recodification.
Yeah.
All of the repealers are in back, but I'm guessing that there is language on page 29 about unfair trade practices. So it's reinserted. So, Senator Scogin, if you look, they are repealing. Were you looking at the repealer piece?
Yes.
If you come back, I don't know if there's anything that you repealed that you didn't deal with again.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
You put everything back.
Everything is back in there.
Okay.
And we would certainly not ever get rid of that piece.
But good reading there, Senator Scogin. You know what to look for. This will have to go to judiciary. And
and we'll make our presentation just as short there.
I serve on that committee, Mr. Commodore, and I it never goes that easy there. I have a bill that's about due up in judiciary.
Madam Chair, could I borrow
Senator
him for
Scogin.
My bill?
Going
much quicker.
Senator Marty, did you have a
question?
No,
Madam Chair, I was just glad I'm not on judiciary.
Senator Gerlach.
Madam Chair, I'll say the reason it has to go to judiciary is Section 12 has some criminal penalties.
Okay. And, you know, and that's really all that they'll look at.
Yes. Section 12.
They're not a whole lot more eager to learn about viaticals.
Maybe not. And, it's up to them.
But we know it's important that it be regulated. Is there anybody else who would like to testify? Yes, Mr. Coyle. And if I walk out, it's not because of anything anybody said. Senator Marty, I'd ask you to take over if I have to go do a bill down in judiciary. Welcome. Good evening.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Coyle. I represent a company by the name of Coventry First. Coventry is a life settlement provider, active nationally in the life settlement industry. I appreciate the time to speak this evening. It's obvious that you want to get on with the bill and move on with the evening. But I say very respectfully to the senator who I met with earlier today and to the committee that this is a very complicated, very technical bill. And it only got introduced late last week. We had contact with Department of Commerce staff about the text of it today for the first time. Barely have had an opportunity to talk with my client about it. That's my problem, not yours. But when Senator Prettner-Solon asked the question about the scale of the amendment, you look at the repealer section, it's 5 pages. This is a 30-page bill. There's lots of stuff in here. And I would say with all due respect, it deserves, respectfully, a lot more consideration than may be possible this evening. So I wanted to just make that statement. This may be a bill that we can support at the end of the day, but we just simply haven't been given the time and the opportunity to provide the constructive comments. I offered some comments to the department this afternoon. Appreciate that Senator Gerlach was able to adopt one of the changes that we had requested. But I would say that there is a need for a lot more discussion to ensure that this is done fairly and correctly. I'll just offer as one example. I'm not going to try to go through the body of the bill because, frankly, there's a lot of pieces in it that I don't even understand. And so I can only imagine how difficult it is for you in your position. But if you go to Section 7 of the bill, which begins on page 14, this is just one example. This provides a whole raft of disclosure applications for what are referred to as viatical providers, but Senator Prettner-Solon, it also encompasses, of course, life settlement providers. This obligates the life settlement industry to tell their customer that, oh, by the way, before you do this, you really ought to know that there are other traditional life insurance tools that you could be pursuing short of pursuing a life settlement transaction. And I asked the department, well, are you imposing this reciprocal burden on the life insurance industry so that when somebody is going to lapse their policy, which is what 90% of the policies do before they ever mature, are you going to impose on the insurance industry a reciprocal burden to notify their consumer that, you know, by the way, there's a life settlement industry out there. You might want to check that out. That's not part of the bill, and it's not something that they're prepared to move on.
Although, Mr. Coyle, they do regulate the insurance industry.
No, I'm not suggesting otherwise. I'm just dealing with the disclosure aspects. So that's just one area that I identified. I'm not going to take any more time on it than that. I just wanted you to know that we oppose the bill in its current form, respectfully to Senator Gerlach. We'll certainly continue to work with him on it. I would also just note for the committee, this is the NAIC Model Act. It's been rejected in most of the states that have dealt with it. The vast majority of them that have acted on life settlement topics have adopted an alternative bill, the NCOIL bill, which is also a model act. That's been introduced by Senator Sparks, but it's not yet been heard in this committee.
I'll stop, Senator. Mr. Coyle, I don't think that this is the NAIC Model Act concerning life settlements. This is a model act having to do just with viatical settlements. There's, you know, the NAIC Life Settlement Act has a 5-year ban. The model act has a 5-year ban on life settlements. I don't know. I don't think that's in here. People are shaking their heads no. I will absolutely respect your right to continue to comment on this. And the bill will go to judiciary, and we'll continue to work on it. It is very technical. And So I'm sorry you didn't have it sooner. We didn't have it sooner. And it just took a long time to get through the process of getting to us. But it wasn't that Senator Gerlach didn't want to get it introduced. We knew it was coming. We knew it was coming, and it finally did. So I do need to go present a bill. So I'm going to ask Senator Marty, who came and took my gavel, to please chair for me.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Coyle. Further witnesses wish to speak to the bill?
I don't have any.
Senator Gerlach.
I'd like to renew my motion that Senate File 1539 pass or be recommended to pass and be referred or as amended and be referred to the Judiciary Committee.
On that motion, any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Now that we got control of the gavel, this meeting's adjourned.